Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman, brought to you by globalresearch.ca. Visit the site, lots of new material up on it today. And again, I ask that listeners who can do it, who are able, Global Research accepts help contributions only from readers, those who can support the site and the work that it does. We're all volunteers. Nobody gets paid for any of this. I'm a volunteer on this program as well. In my second career, I'm retired. I had my first working life. This is the second one, all volunteer. But those who can help out, we would appreciate it. And it keeps a site like Global Research going. It's an award-winning site, and it just gets better and better all the time. I'm proud to make a small contribution to it. And this program goes right along with it, and we've got a terrific program today. One of my personal favorites, my goodness, I've read so many of his books, Michael Parenti. Michael Parenti is back today. And Michael, for so many years, he's been an internationally known political scientist. He's an award-winning author and lecturer. He's written so many books. Michael, I've read every one of them except maybe one or so. I'm not finished introducing you yet, but I'll welcome you to the program. We're connected, right?
Right, yeah.
Oh, Michael, welcome to the program. Oh, so many terrific books you've written. One of them, in fact, I bought twice. I don't buy books twice, but I bought this one twice, Democracy for the Few.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I read it years ago, and then I bought the latest edition, I think the 8th edition, a couple of years ago, and we talked about it the last time you came on the program. Your newest book is a Michael Parenti reader. You call it Contrary Notions, the Michael Parenti reader.
Right.
You've done so much for so many years, Michael. There's another one of your books that I think is appropriate, and I just wanted to mention it briefly, maybe kick off this conversation. I think you wrote the first comprehensive media critique called Inventing Reality. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, I think so, yeah.
Before people really en masse realized the terrible state of the media, the dominant media and how corrupted it is, and there were no programs like this. Well, if there were any, there certainly weren't many. This one wasn't around way back then, but we know just the state of the media today, and I think it's highlighted by what's going on now, well, in so many respects, but the one that's making the world daily headlines around the clock on the so-called fine swine flu scare. It's a complete scam. People are being terrified over something that doesn't exist. Same thing happened a few years ago with the avian flu. I put out an article today.
Could I add something to that, Steve?
Oh, absolutely. Go right ahead.
Well, the same thing happened with the swine flu in 1976, and President Gerald Ford went and spent hundreds of millions of dollars to develop a vaccine and supposedly get it out, and no flu developed. And I think that helped him lose the election, his re-election to Jimmy Carter. We do know that about 36,000 Americans die of flu or flu-related symptoms every year, and right now. So,
and it's got nothing to do with swine or
it's got nothing to do with swine, right? Exactly.
Michael, that music means we need to take a break. Let's do that, and we'll come right back and pick this up. We'll be right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Michael Parenti. Oh, we'll get into a number of issues in the program today, including Michael's most recent article on Global Research called Capitalism's Self-Inflicted Apocalypse. Ooh, that's a tongue twister. Michael, I don't remember Gerald Ford doing that in 1976. That was so long ago. But in 2005, during the avian flu, the beginning of the scare about that, the Pentagon ordered everybody in the military vaccinated against avian flu, and they spent $1 billion, and then George Bush asked Congress to appropriate another $2 billion to stock up on Tamiflu, a dangerous drug, a dangerous drug. When all was said and done on avian, Michael, at most it killed a few hundred people. And as you say, influenza, just normally, because it can affect so many people around the world, there's just a normal number of deaths, 30-odd thousand people. You never hear that make headlines, do you?
No, you really don't. And when they come up with the flu, as Gerald Ford did, of course, first of all, that's millions of dollars in profits for certain companies that provide this so-called vaccine. And a number of people simply who were healthy and got the vaccine flu shot ended up getting paralyzed or seriously disabled or dying. So the vaccine, the cure, the quote cure, can be worse than the disease.
Oh boy, is it ever! Is it ever? You want another stat? I'll give you. I wrote an article I put out today that what's going on with the daily round the clock headlines. Just one more reason to get so upset. It's being done. Michael, you've written so much about this stuff. It's done certainly to profit the drug companies that cash in on this. In this case, currently, it would be Roche and Gilead Sciences. Gilead is the company that Donald Rumsfeld was the chairman of from 1997 to 2001, still a major stockholder. So he's cashing in. He cashed in on avian. He's cashing in now. I don't know how many more millions he needs, but he'll make a few more because of this.
Yes, well, that's a good point, you know, that these people who have more money than they know what to do with are just really addicted, and they just want more and more and more, and it comes at our expense. That's the problem.
I think another big issue is when other big things are going on, like the economic crisis that's affecting so many millions of people in this country alone, they change the subject. They divert our attention to talk about a health threat that absolutely would scare people. That could be today, this morning, this afternoon, tonight, tomorrow. And, loss of job and loss of home, well, that can wait for another day. But that's the big issue, plus the foreign wars and the rest, and the absolute looting that the Wall Street bankers have done in causing the problem we're in, and then getting rewarded with trillions of our tax dollars for their crimes, where ordinary people are suffering so much. And heaven help anybody who gets in trouble and commits a very petty act can end up serving a long prison sentence, but not the Wall Street bankers that still steal countless trillions of dollars and the wealth they destroy. So change the subject, Michael. Scare people to death with a non-existent threat and just keep this thing going. That they pick their spots. I think they pick their moment to bring this out. Now, why it was now and not a month ago or a month from now, I don't know. But I think they picked this spot and they broke this story in recent days.
Well, it's a speculation, but one can't help speculating that way. One can't help wondering why they're making such a big thing out of this flu condition, which, by the way, focuses around one American meat packing and meat slaughter pork company in Mexico, which went down there thanks to NAFTA. They closed their factory in the U.S. where they had to face a lot of environmental restrictions and health restrictions and OSHA, occupational safety restrictions, and they went down to Mexico, opened up this factory under the worst terrible conditions awful contaminations going on around there. That's where most of the deaths occurred. It shouldn't be called, as one person suggested, it shouldn't be called the Mexican swine flu. It should be called the NAFTA swine flu. And it's happening just in that one area. why that's becoming, that's being blown up into a pandemic, a global pandemic, one has to wonder if they aren't just trying to distract the people and get their minds off the questions that they're beginning to raise about the nature of our system, how it's been misused and played against us for the benefit of the very few.
Oh, indeed. And of course, your book, Democracy for the Few, went into this in very great detail. It really is a sensational book, Michael, and it certainly is sold well. 8 editions now?
Yes. The more recent book I have is called Contrary Notions.
Yeah.
Michael, you did mention it, that's right. The reason I prefer to recommend that one is because Contrary Notions is marketed as a textbook, so it's very expensive, I'm sorry to say. And Contrary Notions is a very readable and affordable book.
Now, why do they market it as a textbook?
Because
they get a few extra bucks?
Well, no, it's used that way. For years, it was used as an alternative text at college level, in some cases even high school level, and that was just the market that it had, and it's marketed in a different way. And all textbooks, that's a story that maybe people who have been out of college or out of school or never went to college don't know about, but the costs of school today are outrageous. My book, I think that book sells for $60, so I don't want anybody to go shell that out. It's terrible.
Oh, my
and that's one of the more reasonable books. I mean, most textbooks cost $100, $120, $150.
Oh, standard text that a professor would assign in class?
Yes, yes.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you and I are of the same generation. We remember back in our school days when texts were very, very reasonable. And, well, college tuition was very, very reasonable. You could go to a top school, and you did, I did, and I paid for nearly all of it myself with part-time work and summer jobs. You can't do that now unless maybe a Wall Street firm will hire you and pay you big money for a couple of months. But, I mean, that's impossible today. So,
yeah, students are leaving school today with anywhere from debts that range anywhere from $25,000 to $75,000 or $100,000, and they end up not being able to pay it. You know, you don't have that much earning power when you just step out of college, and at the interest rates, the interest compounds and all, and a debt that started out to be let's say $50,000 in a couple of years, you owe $70,000. And you know, the interest compounds and accumulates quicker than what you can pay off. You pay little pieces of it, and yet it keeps growing. So it's a kind of debtor's prison without walls. They put a lien on your earnings, and you're trapped with that debt for the better portion of your life coming up. It's a crazy system, and a lot of people don't know about it, and it's intensely unfair. Much of the student loan industry is in the hands of private profiteers and racketeers of all sorts. I mean corporate racketeers, not the ones on the street.
Michael, it sounds like on an individual basis, doing to poor students, to do it to poor people, whether they're students or in any other capacity, but it sounds like on a one-on-one kind of deal, it's the same thing that the big international banks do to developing nations.
Right.
They get them hopelessly in the debt, and the idea is never to repay the debt, but just keep sucking debt service out of these countries to keep them in permanent debt bondage. So you're basically, a nation becomes enslaved in debt. And there's only one way out of it, and that's to default. But very few nations take that course. Some do, but very few.
Well, if they do that, they really face penalties like retaliation from the lending nation, cut off of export markets, and the like. So,
oh, indeed. I was thinking of the Marines.
Right, or sending the Marines.
The, the ultimate collection agency.
Really? You know, let me say on individual debt, when they talk about Americans, you hear this kind of preachment. American, it's a form of blaming the victim. Americans have to learn to live within their means and the spending sprees they had in the past. You know, it's like we're just all a bunch of shopaholics or something. That's really not true. Most Americans who go into credit card debt, for instance, it's because of loss of job or serious illness and with no coverage, and they have to get money desperately, and the only thing available to them is that $10,000 credit line, you know, and or divorce or physical and health incapacity. That's the single biggest one, that one and loss of job. Those are the reasons Americans go into heavy debt. It's not because they're a bunch of spendthrifts or go on shopping sprees and the like.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Also, home refinancings, when that got to be pretty hot in the earlier part of this decade.
That's right, paying for your home.
Oh, it's just ugly. In so many respects, Michael, we need to take another break. Let's come back and talk about your last article on global research, capitalism self-destroying itself. I believe it. We'll be right back.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Michael Parenti. Michael, your article back in late January on global research about capitalism, self-inflicted apocalypse, you wrote how in point of fact, capitalism runs counter to democracy and prosperity. If we think of prosperity as having a generally positive effect for at least the majority of people in a country that calls itself a democracy. And you quoted Louis Brandeis. I don't think you could imagine how bad things have gotten today, but you quoted him, and I've quoted him a few times on this one myself, a former Supreme Court justice way back, who said we can either have democracy or we can have concentrated wealth in the hands of a few. Boy, do we ever have that, and look what it's brought us. It was a great article.
Thank you, Steve. The article argues that you can't credit capitalism with democracy when, in fact, the economic royalists, the rich merchants, big landowners, bankers, and such, over the centuries, back in the 1800s and the 1900s, opposed every democratic reform that we had when people tried to eliminate property qualifications for voting and office holding. The very rich few opposed that change and fought against it very hard. When we tried to propose universal manhood suffrage, that was opposed. The vote for women, that was opposed. The anti-segregation movement was opposed by the wealthy property owners and such. So they have really, been enemies of democracy. Economic and social democracy, the right to social security, the right to a minimum wage, abolition of child labor, the right to collective bargaining with unions and such, all of those things, of course, were vehemently opposed by the plutocracy. So how can you credit, and why would you credit them with being the propagators of democracy when in fact they were the most energetic and vehement opponents? And the prosperity, whatever prosperity we earned again was through the people's own popular struggle. The plutocrats fought against every gain we've ever made, a decent living wage, affordable housing, environmental protection. They opposed all these things. They still do. They still do to this day. They still want to roll back and oppose these things. And as you pointed out about the development of prosperity in third world countries, their goal has been to go into these countries and plunder them, to take their resources, to exploit their labor at barely subsistence wages and the like. So it's not prosperity. They didn't bring us prosperity. To the extent that we have any kind of prosperity, it just came with the struggles waged by working people themselves.
Any positive changes, as you know, Michael, and I know as well, it comes from the bottom up, from the grassroots. And these people that run the country, whether it's the key government officials or the key corporate heads of companies, the big bankers especially, the heads of the media, their intent and their purpose and their mission is to get as much for themselves, and that means taking it from us. I guess you can think of prosperity, Michael, in zero-sum terms. There's only so much of it to go around, and they literally want limitless amounts of it, which means there's only one way they can get it, and that's to take it from us, and they do it relentlessly.
Absolutely, and you know, we talk about the present crises we're in, but it was John Maynard Keynes who said that he wasn't unfriendly to capitalism, but he did marvel at the system. He said it's amazing that the most wickedest of men, operating from the most wickedest of motives and intentions, astonishingly are credited with the benign beneficial outcomes, and that's just not true. But he also pointed out that the system is always in crisis. We talk about this crisis or that, but if you look back, you know, there was the panic of 1792, there was the panic of 1803, and they last a few years, and before you know it, there's another one by 1815 or 1820, and there's one in 1830, and there are these recessions and market crises, and then comes inflation, then comes a war or something like that to get us out, and then comes some record spending to try to spend out of it. But this has been the history of it all, you know, for centuries here. And more recently, we had the, we had that runaway inflation of the 1970s, which really was the economy catching up to Richard Nixon's spending on the Vietnam War. I'll continue after the music.
Oh, you're there playing that song, Michael. It's such an ugly story when you strip the mask off the system. It could be a lot better than it is, but when people get greedy, these are the things that happen. Let's take a break and we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Hour. I'm on with Michael Parenti. Michael, there are so many strands of trouble in our very, very troubled system. You can look at so much. The fact that our country especially is so militarized, where we literally spend more on militarism, so-called defense, foreign wars, and the rest, including what we do at home, and the rest of the world combined. This alone may end up bankrupting us someday. But since at least the late 1960s and 1970s, we started producing less, and financialization took over the economy, began getting more and more dominant. So now the biggest industry the major banks, and the, I guess what you could call the FIRE sector, finance, insurance, and real estate. That sector combined, this powerful sector, and at least as far as the banking end of it goes, point the finger at the big Wall Street banks and Bank of America that's not headquartered on Wall Street, but a global bank like the others. They don't produce anything. Banking is a small part of their business. Their global casino is the main part of their business. And they don't produce, they extract. They take, they don't add back. So they create, they're in the business of creating misery to get rich. Add to that, Michael, the fact that we could have a system that would operate much better, as imperfect as it is, by having the government exercise its constitutional right by creating money and not letting private bankers do it, as they have been since 1913 with the creation of the Federal Reserve.
That's right.
So we have a private banking cartel running the nation's money system. It basically does what it wants. The Federal Reserve has nothing to do with being part of the government. It's all a mirage. It operates out of an impressive building in Washington that makes it look like it's a government building, but it's not. And if the government printed its own money, we could have debt-free, inflation-free money and a lot more prosperity and stability than we have by turning this over to private bankers.
Who then print the money at their own will, just print it out of thin air, and then give the money. These are bankers who then give the money to other bankers, a couple of trillion dollars to the big banks and insurance and loan companies.
The banks have this magic way of creating money. Michael, the first time I learned about it back in school, I said, oh, my God, that's a terrific business. I think I want to be a banker. Fractional reserve banking, so that for every dollar of deposits they get from you or me or anybody else, like magic, they have to keep something like a 10% reserve requirement, but I believe that's fast disappearing, so there may be no reserve requirement, but let's just say 10%. They can, through fractional reserve banking, they can multiply that to 10 times that amount.
And
so if, let's say they get $1 million, they can make $10 million out of that. They keep $1 million in reserve, and they can loan out $900,000. What a business. Like sticking your hand in your pocket and magically pulling $900,000 out of it.
Right. Well, if I'm a banker and you deposit, let's say, $5,000 of your hard-earned money, well, I now have a debit of $5,000, but I also have an asset of $5,000. I mean, it's become money I owe you, and yet it's money that I make money on. It's an interesting system. I mean, it's for the bankers and by the bankers. It's true. And it's also, it's not doing anything to help the economy. I mean, the trillions that have been lent out have not created new jobs. They're not reversing the downward spiral of, you know, declining spending, layoffs, less spending, less buying power, more layoffs, less buying power. Right. So it's a way of what we used to call feeding the sparrows through the horses. If you've ever seen horses, you know, they eat the oats and pass some of it out, and then the sparrows come flying down and pick the little bits out of it. And this seems to be what we're expected to do. It's a trickle down with these very powerful, big, sticky hands up there at the top, scooping it up, and the taxpayer then will have to make up for it. This is not, and Obama, I think, should be faulted for seeming to be absolutely unwilling for the government to be directly financing the real economy, you know, just lending money directly, which is what the New Deal did with the NRA, the National Recovery Act, and other things to get businesses going again. Real businesses, what they're doing is lending out thousands of dollars there, or eventually thousands, while trillions are going into the hands of these big institutions.
Oh, indeed, and they're using it not to lend out money and create economic growth, but to consolidate, to buy other assets on the cheap,
exactly.
To pay out big bonuses.
And why the Obama administration, why Geithner continues to give them money, supposedly to excuse me, I'm sorry, that was my fault, and supposedly to restore the credit flow, and you hear the president saying it's necessary, but these bankers are not lending the money out. They've got money to lend out. They got money of their own. And of course, you give them money, they'll take it too. But they're not lending it out because, as they say, there aren't enough qualified borrowers. They don't lend money to people who need it. They lend money to people who can show that they can pay it back within 30 days or 60 days or whatever the like. So again, the money is not trickling down. It's not having a multiplier effect. You're giving money to the rich, and the poor are paying for it. I used to say we borrow money from the people we should be taxing, but now we give money to the people we should be taxing and taking it from.
Oh, indeed. I think a positive step, maybe the biggest step we could take to begin to get the economy back on a positive track for renewed growth would be to close down all of the major banks. They're all insolvent, which is really a polite way of saying they're bankrupt. But these bailouts and the fiction, we put a mask over their problems, and we claim that, we're doing these things to get the economy to be healthy again.
Wait, Steve, is that true, though? Are they really?
They really are.
I thought
a number
of them have lots of money. They're now refusing some of the money because it's coming with strings attached, which is tell us what your CEOs are making and why are they making that much and this, that. And they're refusing the money. And then there were a few that announced very good record profits this last quarter.
Oh, they manufactured it, Michael. They don't have any profits. They have huge losses. They just don't take them.
Mm-hmm.
I
know they dropped December, didn't they? The disaster.
The accounting agency that makes the rules, so-called GAAP, generally accepted accounting practices. They changed the rules so that these toxic assets that they've been writing down for months, they don't have to do it anymore. So they've got all of this bad junk, toxic stuff on their books. It just sits there. They don't write off losses, so they manufacture profits. They, honest to God, don't have profits. They are all in the red, and they have trillions. The bank that the two banks that are called the healthiest of the big ones, J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs. Well, J.P. Morgan Chase has something like 70-80 trillion with a T dollars of toxic stuff, junk on their balance sheet. I mean, this stuff, I don't know that it's worthless, but what's it worth? 10 cents, 20 cents, 30 cents on the dollar?
Nobody really knows.
Well, nobody knows, and I imagine J.P. Morgan has the best idea, but they're not saying. And then they come up with these programs, like this PPIP program, this partnership with the government, where the government puts up, where the bank puts up, I'm sorry, where a buyer who may want to buy some of this junk will put up a minute fraction of the cost, and the government will put up the rest. So the taxpayers will take the losses if they occur, and they will at some point. And the banks can unload some of this stuff. Well, part of what they're doing is to buy each other's toxic junk by putting up 5% of the cost. The government puts up 95% of the cost, and they're swapping off their toxic junk on each other. And, I mean, this is a con game that's going on, but they have so much of it, Michael, that I don't know how this thing can work. I mean, they may get rid of a couple of trillion dollars of this bad stuff, but what are they going to do with the rest? So you've got J.P. Morgan Chase, you've got Citibank, you've got Bank of America, Goldman Sachs has a lot of it. I think the money they want to give back is this, the first money that was handed out, this TARP money, $350,000, they got $25 billion here, $10 billion there. They talk about this stuff like it's pocket change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they want to give back that, but on the other hand, they're taking in vast sums that far exceed this, that apparently don't have these strings attached to it. Again, it's a dirty business. And you mentioned Geithner. Well, my goodness, I mean, he's part of the dirty system. He was president of the New York Fed.
Absolutely.
And he's been very well, Larry Summers, same thing.
And his friend, I was just about to say, his friend Lawrence Summer.
They made millions of dollars on the side by sort of being on the payroll of these organizations. Larry Summers, when he was president of Harvard, was making millions of dollars from an array of things, being associated with one or two private hedge funds, getting insider information on how to trade. So the last year, one of them, D.E. Shaw, I think it was, they had a very successful trading year last year when everybody else was crashing. Well, my goodness, how on earth did they do it? Well, I guess any of us can do it, Michael, when you learn in advance the way you should place your bets. It's like getting tomorrow's Wall Street Journal 24 hours in advance. You could get very rich if you could get that. I'd like to contact the journal and ask them, what would you charge me for a subscription of tomorrow's paper today?
Yeah, right.
It's very dirty, and these people have rigged the system to benefit themselves, just the way you write. You wrote an article months back on how the elections are rigged to see to it that the people they want elected are elected. So we got George Bush for 8 years, and the winners end up losers, and the losers end up winners. And what can you say?
Well, what we can say is that we're going to ask people to inform themselves, let their anger register on their elected representatives, on the community publications and radio stations and whatever outlets they can reach, and to join together as much as they can to kind of resist this plunder of our whole future and our commonwealth is just being plundered. It's true. And if you let these banks go under, they keep saying they're too big to fail. I don't know if that's even true. That's a slogan that was invented some years ago, and it's become like a gospel religious incantation, a mantra now. Oh, they're too big to fail. The Lehman Brothers have failed. I didn't see the world go. They didn't create any vast suction going down. So it would be very hurtful and harmful for them, for those at the top, if their pet institutions failed and most of their wealth went down with it. But that doesn't. I don't know if the real economy would disappear.
Oh, it wouldn't. It would
anything, of course. You have people still will want to work and earn money and pay their rent and buy food and grow food and eat food. And, the real economy will be there, and it's that real economy, as I say, has been ignored and not looked at very well, not given all that much help. That one stimulus package is really not enough, and most of the money is going to them that already have the money.
Oh, indeed. I got a note in the mail. You probably got something like this as well. I got it in the last week that I will get a one-time, we're both on Social Security, I'll get a one-time check for $250. Like that's going to make all the difference in the world to me or to anybody else. Oh, to somebody who's going hungry today, that $250 will come in handy, at least for a short time.
Right.
But it will be quickly used up, and you're right back in the same soup again. Now, I think the problem is these predatory bankers, and the healthiest thing we could do is just invert that too big to fail idea and say they're too big to exist. Unless we shut them down and get rid of them, or break them up in small pieces and just prevent this kind of size from happening. I did nothing against mom-and-pop capitalism, Michael. I was part of a small family business most of my working life. We weren't predators, and we never got a nickel in corporate welfare. we were sink or swim all the way, and we nearly sunk a few times. We just wanted to make a living. We didn't want to cause any harm to anybody. If we went back to the Adam Smith ideology of small and local, Adam Smith would be absolutely outraged at the kind of system that that is so common today, at least in the West. The big Asian economies as well, and we want the whole world to be this way. So the Soviet Union dissolves at the end of the 1980s, Michael, and those poor countries, they may not have had Valhalla under communism, but they had no idea what hell was about to come their way, and they are literally going through a hellish situation now, and there is great, great unrest in these former Soviet republics. At least
yes,
the Eastern European
by, I'm sorry, Steve, to bring him, but a study by Richard Pipes, of all people, and a few other of the former Sovietologists who are always very, very critical of Soviet Union. That recent study they just did show that people in these countries say that communism was better than what they got now, that at least they had jobs and at least they had affordable medical care and free education and the like. This is the part that people never heard about communism, which is not to justify any of the oppression that took place.
Oh, no. Stalinism
is terrible. So today, economically anyway, they're worse off than they were before.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about it. There are riots in Eastern Europe now because of what's going on. Oh, my goodness, we have to take another break, and we'll come back. I want to give the last segment all to you, Michael.
This is RVN. The Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. On with Michael Parenti. Michael, you in your article on capitalism, self-inflicted apocalypse, that free market corporate capitalism. I think maybe put corporate in caps, but you say it's a disaster waiting to happen, and its way of life is devouring ours, but eventually it will devour itself and, of course, threaten our way of life. Oh, I absolutely believe that. Your comments?
The big corporate capitalist system is not there to make cars. It's not there to make clothing or grow food or housing. It does some of those things, I mean, eventually, but the goal is, above all, to make profits, and it's not there to protect our environment. I mean, they'll destroy half of the forests around you in a day if they can make a quick profit from it. So their goal really is not an economy of use and of value. Their goal is an economy of plunder and rip-off. And the goal is also to charge as high a price and to pay their workers as low wages as they possibly can. So you got this contradiction that wages, which cut into profits, have to be kept down. But wages, which are the thing that, which is the buying power of the economy, have to be kept up. And what these crises are, in many cases, is overcapacity, is what they call it, overproduction, that they keep building, investing, and the like, and there aren't enough people around with the money to buy these homes or these cars or this, that, or the other thing. So there's this constant instability, constant flux. In addition to the even more gargantuan aberration that you have been pointing out so well, Steve, that you've got this other super economy superimposed upon it, which doesn't produce anything, which is capital reinventing itself, repackaging itself to resell and to inflate and blow up and making money off money. People who most of the profits today come from financial speculation rather than from industrial production. So our economy has shifted away from manufacturing and production to this kind of finance and speculation and Ponzi deals and the alike. And those who say, well, today's misfortunes are just due to a few scoundrels such as Bernie Madoff and the like, I would point out that this argument is this structural and systemic, or is it just individual greed? These two things are not mutually exclusive, that the system really rewards those people who plunder, those people who deceive, those people who fabricate money and at our cost, those people who steal from the taxpayers and the public treasure. The system is geared to reward them at the expense of, and like, let's say, small business people like your family was.
Oh, they would just squash us like an ant and never give it a second thought, Michael. It's also so amoral. The human fallout simply is not an issue. Human beings, human capital is to be used to make more money and to grow bigger and stronger and more powerful. And all the other issues simply don't matter. My goodness, that music means we're out of time. Every hour just flies by, Michael. It was terrific being on with you again. And you were a jewel getting up early in the morning to come on with me. Many, many things.
Yes, I usually don't do morning, but for you I did. Okay.
Oh, bless you. Bless you for coming on. In my email I said a sleepy Perini is better than most others I could think of.
That was
and it was a great hour, Michael. I hope we can do this again soon.